It's time for Mac Break Weekly. We've got a great panel for you. Andy and Nacos here. Alex Lindsay's in studio. Renee Ritchie's got the day off, but Lori Gill is filling in for him from iMore. We're going to talk about the big lawsuit against Apple. That butterfly keyboard, my goodness, I wonder what's going to happen to it on the next Mac laptop. We'll also talk about the $100 billion Apple's spending on stock buybacks and what Ralph Nader thinks about that. A whole lot more. All coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 610, recorded Tuesday, May 15th, 2018. The Butterfly Effect. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by WordPress. Reach more customers when you build your business website on WordPress.com. Plans start at just $4 a month. Get 15% off any new plan purchase at WordPress.com/MacBreak. And by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? ZipRecruiter has revolutionized how you do it. Their technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. They find great candidates for you. Try it free today at ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak. And by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software that helps small business owners thrive. Try it free for 30 days at FreshBooks.com/MacBreak. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple. Andy Anako's here from the almost said it. From the
veteran,
Fast Company.
Veteran of the Chicago
Do you have a big announcement this week, or you were hinting you might?
I'm hinting that plans that were sort of ephemeral a few weeks ago are becoming real, in that things have been bought and done. But so basically priming the pump for an announcement that will come probably nice. Just after WWDC. I don't want to do it. I was hoping to get it done before WWDC, but now it won't be done enough before WWDC that anybody will pay any attention to it. So,
wow, are you cryptic? Anyway, it's great to have you. Cryptic. If you want to find what he's up to right now, go to ihnatko.com or
I'm the wind, baby.
ihnatko. I have no idea how to spell your name. Atco. Also, you should get an acronym for the whole name, not just the first three letters, but I'm just saying.
I could just change my name to Smith, but then I have to say, no, it's with a Y, not with an I.
You would be that guy. Alex Lindsay's here from the Pixel Core. He's working on some 3D project. Or is this something?
I kind of consider photo scan or photogrammetry kind of knitting. So like when I'm fiddling around, I throw photos into it and then my computer goes back to work. And so I had this little thing I bought in India, this little stamp. And
It's a 3D of the stamp.
It's a 3D model of
the stamp. Neat. So I couldn't feel like it. It looks really cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was just, and I had shot it this morning from on my porch.
And joining us once again, I'm so glad she's back. This is her third time. Rock star. Appaholic and deputy managing editor iMore, Lori Gill. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thanks. Thanks they for having me. I consider knitting to be knitting. I just knit.
Do you knit?
Yeah.
My mom taught me to knit. I can see how that would be very soothing.
It is when you're watching a movie or just kind of sitting around the house, especially in the wintertime.
And then you get scarves.
And like you get scarves and hats and gloves and socks and all kinds of fun stuff.
Back when I was addicted to Farmville. My wife said, "You're farming again." I said, "Yeah." She said, "Why don't you just knit? At least you'd have something at the end of the day."
that's kind of like there's a couple things, whether it's stitching panoramas or photogrammetry, which the computer does most of the work. So you're kind of like you don't have to think about it very much. You just kind of throw things in and see how it cooks on the way out. And so it's something you can kind of do while you're fiddling with other things. And I have a couple computers that are almost constantly running.
Yeah. Do you make scarves, Lori? Is that mostly what you knit or?
I've made scarves and hats and socks and leg warmers, gloves.
Do you mostly just
knitting,
or do you
the only thing I haven't done is made shirts, like sweaters. I haven't done that.
Do you do stitch work as well? Is it just knitting or is it?
Stitching is too much. You have to go like this. Stitching is not. I think knitting's nice because you don't have to look at it.
Just go. Yeah. So, I mean, I knit, I crochet, I do some stitch work, but not a bunch. It's just a fun little crafty thing to keep your hands busy. So, you know.
They sent Lori to Google I.O. across the aisle, so to speak, to see if you could handle all the Google goodness. You had an interesting take on it, actually.
Yeah. So what I kind of learned from listening to what the speakers at Google had to say was it's time to kind of come together and stop being so divided with our platforms. And I'm sure there's a lot of things that you know are under the table that I don't really understand, but it seemed very inclusive and very trying to promote inclusivity amongst the platforms instead of, you know, I'm an iPhone or I'm an Android phone, and how about let's just have the same stuff across devices. I know that's not the easiest thing to kind of develop, but I love this idea. I saw some of the things that Google was doing and thought, I really want that for iPhone. I saw some other things that Google was doing and they said, and you can do it on iPhone. And I was just so overjoyed with that. I'd love to see a lot more of that kind of coming together of cross-platform sort of unity and developers being able to work on multiple platforms without having to worry about how to do it, how to set, like having separate things that can't be shared. There's more and more people that are using iPhones with PCs, Macs with Android phones. It's just better for all of us if we can be kind of like integrated in our software and usability.
Apple used to be that way when they were a minority operating system.
They're still a minority operating system.
But not with the iPhone. They're a majority operating
system. For the iPhone, but in the phone market,
that's where you start to be, and that's what happens. I mean, I've seen this happen so many times. Microsoft used to be, and then when they started to see their market share slip to iPhone, they, like Google, both Microsoft says exactly the same thing. We just want to work for everybody.
Well, Apple,
you
only
silo
has
it. You only do the ecosystem play when you're dominant enough that you could make it work.
But Apple's only they're a small percentage of the overall phone market.
Yeah. They're
then there's no excuse. They should be more open.
I don't think that Apple is actually so closed off. They are, but I think that it's important for the company to kind of control the content that gets used on their devices.
They refuse to make Apple's messages for Android. What does that tell you?
It tells me that there's reasons behind why they are deciding to make deciding these choices, and they're trying to control what the user has. You know, if I have a device that I think is the most wonderful, perfect device in the world, and somebody puts something on it that makes it less of an awesome experience, I'm to blame for that. And my phone looks bad. So wow. I'm going to control who gets to put stuff on my phone and what they get to put on my phone.
That's their rationalization for doing what's good business. It really comes down to, what's right for users or do you do what's right for the company? What's right for users is to make a messaging platform that operates everywhere. What's right for the company is to try to lock people into your product.
That's some stuff I was starting to realize when I was at I.O. I really appreciate this idea of not locking things in. And it's real beautiful to see that kind of grow technology instead of sort of protecting it. Well, let's grow with it. Let's make it better for all users and stop being so sort of protective of what it is. I completely agree with that.
And to be fair, making software and services that run on everything is to Google's business benefit. They don't sell hardware. They're really not into that business. So that's why it's always funny to hear each CEO or each senior executive talk about the virtues of the company, and they're saying, well, we will never do this, and we believe strongly that the importance of technology, and it's never, and even though it means we're totally have to shoot ourselves in the foot and build an entirely new business model to live by these principles, we have a philosophy that of course has a lot of things tied into it. Doesn't have to be just one thing, and they find the ways to do the best for their users through that philosophy.
But well, that's why my point was you can kind of track a company's attitude towards this by how dominant they are. When they're
they don't have to compete, so they don't.
Exactly. I'm with you, Lori. I mean, I come from an era when, you know, I mean, I still do believe in open computing, open platforms, non-proprietary systems. I believe strongly that's how all of this started. And it was only when companies started to dominate and said, oh, we could take advantage of our market share and close off the other guy, that they'd start being predatory and started looking more towards their interests than the end user's interests. And that's why I think really, and this is radical, all software should be open source and free. But that's very radical to say that.
I think that, I guess from a user perspective, though, I do think that having the company focusing mostly on its platform, I do think makes it more stable. and allows them to innovate in those areas. And I think that what's interesting is that I actually think that, and I think it's Apple's gone a little away from this, but when I think part of the whole thing is the idea that the phone is not as important to Apple as it is to other folks. And so the idea is that you know, we're gonna our job is more to make it simple and easy than it is to necessarily put every bell and whistle into it. And I think that is a different approach to the problem. And I have everything. I have Linux and Windows and Android, and you know, I have everything. The thing that reliably works the best is my phone. It doesn't work all the time, but it is the most reliable, and my Macs are the thing that I know that are going to generally do exactly what I expect them to do when I expect them to. Not always, but on all the OSs that I'm probably, you know, literally a Mac OS is probably less than 50% of my time these days. So I'm spending time in Windows and Android and Linux for a variety of reasons. And they're all, you know, they're all a little unstable, but the Mac is the most stable. And if someone asked me like what I was going to give to my parents, I would not recommend anything other than iOS or the Mac, because it's going to work, you know, and they don't, it's going to save them a lot of time, you know? And so, I think that, I think there is an advantage for Apple beyond just the business model of lock-in to be constantly managing that for a certain population, which is a minority of the world, is using their operating system.
But the thing that seems so unusual is that on the one hand they're locking in their usability, but they're also promoting this idea that the Mac or the iPhone is this sort of every man's computer and every man's device, not for the techies, but for everybody. So it's so counter to what I imagine they would want to be doing, which is making all of the technology accessible for everybody. But it seems like they're kind of at odds with both of those thoughts of like, let's make a device that is simple for everybody to use, but let's lock it down so that.
But I think locking it down is what makes it simple.
It's like, yeah, exactly.
That's the thing. You don't play with others.
I keep coming back to an interview that I once read, but with someone who used to work for Walt Disney when he was building the theme parks, Walt, when they were designing Disneyland and Disney World, Walt wanted to make sure that if you came to these parks, you would have a great time. And he felt that was so important. He wanted to make sure you couldn't have a bad time, even if you were trying to have a bad time. And to me, that's Apple. It's the idea that if we control most of the experience, it's not about controlling the user, and it's not about lock-in. It's more that we feel as though a user who gives up the ability to get root access to a phone or command line, that's a small or easily more to the point, more easily move a file from a device onto the phone or the tablet where it can do the user some good. That's a downside, but the upside is greater stability, greater predictability. We don't have to, the user will never have to parse any error codes. We can actually handle errors by simply bouncing people back to the launcher, and that will kind of solve the problem for them, because on the back end, it'll be solved elsewhere and they don't have to deal with it. So, I mean, I've been on cruises, Leo's been on cruises. There are some people that when the ship goes into an exotic port, some people want to spend $140 and be taken to the distillery to have the package tour of the rum factory. Some people just want to hail a cab or jump on a bus and just go wherever they want in this country and in this town that they've never been in before. And the people who go to the rum factory, they're getting what they want out of it. part of that is stability and security and knowing what the experience is going to be like. The people who jump on the bus where they don't understand the money or the map or the language, they're getting what they want, which is the ability to go where their minds want to lead them, even though it might lead them someplace 30 miles away from the ship when it finally has to pull out of port without them.
Yeah, but Apple's kind of like the cruise ship that only lets you go to the rum factory. I mean, it's, right? I mean, well, not so much on the Mac, I have to say.
I think
there's two Apples. And there's the Apple of old days where they really were a minority and they really were the upstarts and they were the computer for the rest of us. And then there's the Apple of the iPhone era where they're absolutely dominant and profit and would very much like to lock people into the Apple ecosystem. And that's why, Laurie, I think you have that odd conflict, is that there's parts of Apple's DNA that really are open and non-proprietary and embracing the world. And then there's parts of them that say, well, from a business point of view, the best thing would be if everybody used iTunes, Apple Music, iCloud, iPhone, and all the rest. And, you know, I'm of the first part. I love Mac. I love Apple from the old days, from the Mac days.
Messages is an interesting case, though, because it's not like you can't move iOS onto generic hardware because there's just too much intimacy between the design of the software and the design of the hardware. You can't do that. But
Apple would never allow it because they're a hardware company.
Messages is probably the one app that Apple has in its portfolio where their messaging on multiple platforms is right now a huge mess. Look at Google, who has just released their 9th, 10th stab at some sort of a cross-platform messaging standard, and their big solution is to try to convince all of the United States carriers to please use this new upgrade to SMS that they're promoting, so that built-in phone messaging apps can handle it. So if Apple were to port messages to Android and to make sure that there was a desktop gateway that would work really, really well, they could own it. Right now, even as an iOS messaging platform, they don't deliver any unique features that are really, really special. But they could add security. They could add multimedia. So I don't know why they don't. Probably because it's a much bigger problem to solve than it is for someone like me to spout off about on a Tuesday afternoon on a podcast. But
I don't think it's hard. I think it's really about lock-in. It's the same reason Steve Jobs hated the idea of making iTunes available on Windows, was fortunately persuaded otherwise, and that was what made the iPod a success. But it's that same mentality. I really think that everything else is cross-platform. Signal's cross-platform, totally secure, totally reliable. Apple couldn't put messages on any platform it wanted to. It doesn't want to.
I just think it doesn't want to bother. They don't have any business reason. I don't think it's so much
of a strong contrary business reason.
With all these companies, you have a lot of things to focus on. You have a certain number of engineers.
Yeah, we've talked about that before.
Am I really going to make more money by making it available on Android? Probably not. So why bother? And I think that's a very valid business decision of, I'm already making plenty of money on this. Why would I bother? I don't think it's as much of a, we're definitely going to hold everybody in and do all those things, other than I just don't have the resources and I'm not interested.
That makes sense.
You know?
Yeah. And from the point of view of consumer, I'll tell you why you bother. The risk that a consumer is going to find a cross-platform solution that they prefer. But you don't have to, because the iPhone has such lock-in that no matter what comes out,
it's a really pleasant little dome to be locked into. I mean,
I agree. If you're using an iPhone, go ahead and try to use an Android. You made the transition.
Yeah, I mean, and to me, not being stuck with one piece of hardware was so important that even before I switched to Android, I just thought, as a matter of principle, I'm going to find alternative to Notes. I'm going to find alternatives to all the apps that I use that are exclusive to iOS. But for a lot of people, they really are people who, despite the luster of the Apple brand, despite how cool iPhones are, they really are walking into a phone store and intending to walk out with a phone, just a practical device that does certain jobs for them. And a lot of people, believe it or not, I'm sorry, I was about to denigrate everyone who uses Apple Maps. But when you compare what Apple Maps can do and how well it does it to what Google Maps can do and how well it does it, it makes me have to really appreciate how important it is to people that, look, there's this app that's already installed. I don't have to download anything. I don't have to learn anything. I tap it and it works. Notes is really competitive for all the other Notes apps out there. they're not really locked in. They're just using the app that they really, really like. So it's a it's a complex set of variables that everybody has to navigate. And if it weren't for the fact that there is such a vibrant alternative ecosystem of mobile apps out there in the form of Android, it'd be a much more serious and grave conversation we'd be having. Apple is the choice, the refuge for people that are absolutely aghast if you present them with 10 choices about how to do something. And Android is for people who either A, want to spend $300 for a phone that would cost $700 if it had an Apple logo on it, and for people who, like, I want to be able to put a contact name like on the springboard. I want to be able to Bluetooth a file from point A to point B. I want to be able to use accessories for my home stereo that don't work on iOS because of sandboxing. So as long as there's that opportunity and those alternatives, I think everybody's in gravy here.
Let's take a little break. When we come back, I want to talk about rumors, of course, WWDC just around the corner. And a class action lawsuit over the Apple keyboard. I'm not going to join it, but I'm some kind of rooting for him a little bit. I just want Apple to put a decent keyboard on the next generation.
We're all looking forward to getting that check for 78 cents when they win the class
action. Yeah, I mean, of course, it's a no-win. And Apple's not going to pay any attention to this. But I just would – we can talk about it when we come back. Yeah, we'll come back in a second. I want to talk a little bit about my blogging platform right now, WordPress.com. Gosh, I love WordPress. Every time I use it, I love it more. I actually have been helping my daughter set up her first website on WordPress.com. She wants to have a site that when people search for her name will reflect her best work, a portfolio, resume, all of that stuff. She's almost graduated from college and she wants to put her best foot forward in the real world. That's the best possible reason to go to WordPress.com. A website is what people see. When they look for you, they find a website. If you're a business, if you're an individual, you want to control that. You don't want it to be limited to your Facebook page, your Twitter account, or what other people say about you. It's so easy. You don't have to be a technologist to create a WordPress site. No coding needed, no design needed. They've got all the tools you need to get your site up and running and beautiful templates. Their customer support team is there 24/7 if you do have any questions Monday through Friday. Weekends, too. They offer great e-commerce solutions ranging from a simple and effective buy button to a complete online store. And it's very affordable. I used to run my own self-hosted WordPress, and I spent more, I thought I'd save money by downloading WordPress and installing it. But you got to include the cost of the server and the cost of your time keeping it up to date and all that. I spent lots more on my self-hosted version than I do at WordPress.com. Plans start at $4 a month. I have the business account, which I love. When you're ready to expand your online reach, WordPress makes it easy with built-in SEO, social sharing, plugins to meet your needs. I use, of course, every WordPress site is secure, HTTPS, which means you rank higher on Google. I use the AMP plugin so my pages load super fast on mobile. There's the world's best anti-spam comment engine comes from WordPress, Akismet. Truthfully, WordPress is dominant in this area. 30% of all websites run on WordPress. That's good news for you in a number of ways. First of all, it shows how many people love WordPress, but it also means developers create tools for WordPress more than any other platform. Get started today with 15% off any new plan purchase. Go to WordPress.com/MacBreak to create your website. WordPress, of course, they have their own WordPress apps, too, on every platform. WordPress.com/MacBreak for 15% off your brand new website. Now, that is a good deal. WordPress.com/MacBreak. Thank them so much for making such great software and making it easy to use and supporting MacBreak Weekly. Lori Gill is here. She's at Appaholic, APPAHOLIK, on the Twitter, deputy managing editor for iMore. And a rock star. I saw you wearing your headphones at the Google I.O. concert because you have tinnitus. And I thought, yeah, me too. Yeah. Me too.
That was silly of me. I actually usually have a pair of earplugs with me everywhere I go, just in case.
I do. I carry them in my briefcase all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. And this time I happened to have left them back at the hotel, which was so ridiculous of me the one night that I was going to see a live concert. So, yeah, that was my mistake. Well,
you want to know the best way?
I still had fun, though. I actually put these headphones on.
They look familiar. Yeah.
Yeah. It helped.
Sure it did. Yeah.
Yeah.
My right ear now is much, the ringing's even louder because I went to a concert about a year ago. Oh, yeah. It's right now.
Mine goes on and off.
Oh, you good for you. Congratulations. I went to a concert. I went to see Hell's Bells, the AC/DC tribute band.
Oh, there you go.
All ladies. And they're so good, but it hit this one ear. And it started ringing and it hasn't stopped since. But I've always had it ringing in my ears because I used to as a kid. Probably like you, Lori, as a rock star, sit too close to those darn speakers and you don't know to protect your ears.
Well, the mistake I made was I spent more than 10 years playing live music without earplugs. So that was really ridiculous of me to do. Yes. If I could go back and tell anybody who's a musician that's listening to this right now, don't be stupid. Wear earplugs because 10 or 15 years down the road, when you get that ringing in your ear and it won't go away, it really bugs you.
So depressing. Although, and I think a lot of people think that older people like me and people with ringing in the ears and don't hear music fully. And even though it's ringing, I hear all of the music. You know, the high end may be attenuated a little bit, but I hear all of the music. I enjoy music just as much as I did.
In fact,
the ringing goes away if the music is loud enough.
I'm sure you've noticed that it kind of hurts to listen to loud music now.
Yes.
Yeah. Whereas when we were younger or when our ears weren't ringing, it didn't actually hurt.
No, it felt good. That's why. I liked it.
Here's a shared experience where the first time you realize that, oh my God, you visit Amazon or something, you realize, oh my God, disposable earplugs are like $1.50. Yeah, I can buy like a whole jar of them and have like three of them in my pocket wherever I go, so that not only like am I protecting my hearing, but I will make the best friend I'll ever make in my life by being at a concert saying, oh, you look like you're in distress. Would you like some earplugs that clearly are in a package that have never been used before? And then it's like they're magic. You put them in your ears and suddenly you're the last time I used them, I was at a 4th of July parade and the fire department didn't understand that. Sirens are meant to be listened to as the truck is driving past at 50 miles an hour, not crawling at walking pace. And so it's like, oh, that's right. I can fix this. Anyway.
When my kids were younger, I carry a whole bag and then I just hand them out to like three rows above in front and below and behind. I just say it was at least a joke and everyone laughed and then people didn't bother me when my kids were crying and upset and everything else.
No, it's really,
I felt better.
I'm going to see Pink on Friday. And nice. You better believe I'll be wearing my my headphones.
Where is she playing?
My earplugs. She's playing at the Oracle Arena.
I pretty much don't go to anything with more than like 500 people now.
Well, I wish you could see people like Pink without.
They should do tours like that.
She's doing all this aerial work. She actually needs somewhere big enough to do. She needs a Warriors style.
Every once in a while, these artists will do these like little 700 to 1,000.
Oh, you always hear the rumors. Oh yeah, the Who, they played at a nightclub downtown after their big gig.
Yep.
And you always think, oh, I wish I'd known that. The Rolling Stones used to do that all the time.
Yep.
I'm not, ethically, I would not be allowed to take like a $10,000 bribe from Apple, but they did. But they did have like Foo Fighters play like a 4-song mini
concert.
That had like only like 300-500 people in it, and that was worth a $10,000 bribe. I was well primed, like my favorite band, and hearing them like and being able to like sit down while listening with people who are not going to just be standing up going woo. Andy paid $500 to see my back and hear me go woo.
You actually met Dave Grohl, didn't you? Did you get a chance to see him or talk to him?
I didn't meet Mr. Grohl. I did meet Mr. Smear.
Oh, nice. Nice. Very nice.
After trying to figure out, how do I address Mr. Smear?
Smear, sir.
I don't know if that's his given name or his confirmation name, or I don't know.
That's one thing I love about Japan. Male, female, first name, last name. If you add san at the end, that's appropriate. I can call you Alex-san. Mm-hmm. Lindsay-san, and it's appropriate, and it works, and it's a sign of respect. I love that. Well, that's what you do. You call him Schmear-san,
or simply in America we have our own customs at work, we just simply call people dude.
Dude.
See?
Dude.
You can do that with everybody.
Alexa and Siri can hear a hidden command that you can't. Actually,
yeah, that's creepy.
Yeah, this is a little misleading. Thank you, New York Times, for this headline. What it really is researchers have figured out a way to send, say, music with commands built in and activate Echoes or Siris and get them to do things. You can hide in 2016, they showed you could hide commands in white noise. That's a little easier because white noise is multi-frequency. But now they're getting to the point where they can put it in recordings of music and even spoken text.
Yeah, there's a lot of fear mongering here. I don't know if this was in the New York Times coverage or the other tech coverage based on the New York Times coverage. So, these commands can order things through Amazon or something. Said no, they can't, because people always don't mention that you actually have to have some sort of a passcode and confirmation with this. It is old news. No, this hasn't been found in the field. And the thing that also kind of encourages me that this isn't going to become a widespread problem is that you realize that after the command has been activated and the device is now communicating with the server to make all this magic stuff happen, the server actually understands the velocity and the type of command that's being sent. It's the reason why, like during a Super Bowl commercial or something, they can have someone in an ad say, "Hey, Alyosha," and 10 million devices don't light up, because by the time that command hits, a system inside that system decides, oh, wait a minute, this isn't one person in Peoria, this is 10 million people all at once. I bet this
That's
is a commercial
point.
Or something, and so yeah. Therefore we're not gonna hit on that command.
But this could be targeted against you particularly, or you could put it in, you know, you could send a text message. You know, with Apple's messages, you could send voice, you could send audio. I mean, it doesn't necessarily trigger a bunch of them. But that Burger King, remember that Burger King ad where the ad said, it was an online ad, I think, what's a Whopper? And I'm sorry, my Google fired. Of course, Google was peeved mightily and disabled that. What had happened is the Burger King folks had modified the Wikipedia page to put an ad in it, and then the Google asks Wiki, you know, gets its answers from Wikipedia. There was a South Park.
I didn't know it was genius.
This is the New York Times. There was a South Park episode, an entire episode built around voice commands that caused viewers' voice recognition assistants to parrot adolescent obscenities. Now that's funny.
That's great.
That's funny.
I mean, I think all these things, when we're having fun with it, I will say that I think that it's great because it shows the developers where the weak points are and what they're doing without causing any real damage, so they can start thinking about what those problems are. And, you know, when it's fun like that, I think it's fine. These obscenities, I think, won't be as fun.
How about this one? This is called the Dolphin Attack. They play stuff at a frequency inaudible to the human ear, especially Lori and my ears, and then it mutes the phone so that the user doesn't hear the system's responses. This is an example of the Dolphin Attack. Comes out of China, by the way.
Hey, Siri, call 1-2-3-4-5-6-7-8-9-0.
Okay, so that was the audible one.
Yeah.
Now let's try it with dolphin sounds. Phone is locked. Listen, see if you can hear it. No.
Yeah, and you can see the screen lighting up and wobbling like Siri.
And it's making the call.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's an easy one to fix just by limiting the frequency that the device is willing to.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know
how hard it would be to do that. But what I think most
to do a low pass at 12K.
To anticipate that the activation. The activation thing isn't being done by a really good processor. It's being done by an ASIC. So maybe the level, I'm speculating here, maybe the level of power of that ASIC isn't enough to do like notch filtering to make sure that I'm not going to listen to anything this beyond a human voice. But I also think that I know that Google is moving really, really fast towards really making sure that it can identify the actual user, the person who's actually authorized to give commands to the device, not only so that if you say, hey, Guillermo, what's my next appointment? Only I get it, and my friend in the house doesn't get it. But also to prevent this kind of a fraud, I think that's what they think that the solution to this is. I think it's going to be a defining standout feature for these things.
Yeah, I think that this idea that it's inaudible is the thing that kind of scares me a little bit. And not to kind of join that fear mongering, but it's not about what it can do now. It's about the potential of what could happen in the future with this kind of stuff. And right now, maybe all an inaudible signal could do is possibly make your phone make a phone call if it happens to be within a few feet of your phone. But the potential of what could happen in the future, I think that same New York Times article talked about technology that could actually trigger your phone to react up to 25 feet away. So they've already improved on what is possible. And at this point, I'm thousands and thousands of people have some kind of smart speaker in their home. Some of us have multiple speakers. Some of us have multiple speakers from different brands. So all of these companies have to get on board to make sure that these speakers are safe enough that they're not going to be triggered by right now might be an innocuous joke or simple gesture that doesn't do much damage, but could potentially do a lot of damage in the future. So I don't know.
I wonder if there's a whole new security stack planned around this, because I know that even before there were smart speakers, there was a concern that a lot of malware was propagating from computer to computers that were not even on a network by letting these computers talk to each other by simply activating microphone, barking out something at an inaudible frequency. But then the microphone in another computer is also sensitive enough to pick up that and understand it and send enough binary data to create an executable that could then do something really, really bad. So I don't know if that has led to security experts who are designing these systems inside hardware to anticipate that sort of thing. But isn't it hardware? Isn't it terrible that the humans, they're so creative and they're so clever. They're wonderful. You almost want to like say, that is a great idea. Put inaudible stuff in speakers so that microphones will pick them up and action on them. But wouldn't it be great if we didn't have to worry about this crap? Stop being so clever about being jerks.
Yeah, you're so smart and cool. Stop it.
I'm just amazed
we're talking about Burger King. You're really, yeah, it's really, really clever, but why don't you put that cleverness into making burgers that actually taste like food?
No, come on.
I'm surprised at how the Amazon product, we'll keep the name out, has become so ubiquitous in my family. We only have it in the kitchen, but asking for timers and asking for the weather and asking for, my kids will just randomly ask it for information. And if it doesn't cough up good information, they'll be like, oh, I'll go Google it now. You know, but the first place they're going to ask is the device, you know, of something that they're trying to figure out. And I'm just amazed that, you know, I didn't really do any work on it at all. I got an Echo Show for my parents as well. And it sat there for a while. They didn't really understand it. And one of my nephews just came over, or nieces came over, and just turned the whole thing on, got it all working. And and now they use it all the time. And so it is something that I think has a lot of use. But and I think that we're going to end up in kind of an arms race for a little while of people doing nefarious things with it and people closing down those nefarious things. I greatly doubt that. I think that hacking IoT for DDoS is probably a bigger fear and much more complicated to defend against than what we're talking about
here. With all these little devices that have no security.
They're not, you know, they're unlocked in there. I mean, you know, and it's, you know, millions and millions and millions of them that are already in the wild. There's nothing to do about them. And it's going to be almost impossible to fix that problem.
I think it will be solved in time by, and we've already seen a little bit of this, trainable voice assistants that can be really locked into your voice.
I think it's going to be locked into. I think it's going to start taking multiple things. It's going to know your voice. It's going to be the fact that you use, your face recognition to log in. It's going to pay attention to the time. It's going to start looking at the heuristics of all your the average thing. And this is something that you wouldn't normally ask for. You know, those are all things that are coming fast.
The proximity of the proximity of your phone.
Right.
Right.
Saying if I can't see your phone on the Wi-Fi network, I ain't paying attention to you.
Apple reached on Thursday a new stock high of $190. The countdown to $1 trillion is on, man. This was, of course, because they're great quarterly results, but also Warren Buffett saying he was going to buy more Apple. He bought a lot of Apple in January. Their current market cap, $913.5 billion. It's getting pretty close to $1 trillion. But here's the stat that just blows me away from CNBC. Apple made more profit last quarter than Amazon has generated during its entire lifetime.
Okay, I call BS on this. I was really surprised that like a business site would be so glib about that, because it doesn't mean that Amazon is unprofitable. It means that Amazon's idea is that when you have profits, you put them right back into the company and develop whole new markets.
Absolutely.
And that's why they have Amazon Echo when nobody else had Amazon Echo. That's why they had Kindle when no one had Kindle. That's why they had Amazon Web Services. And that's why they have moved on from being the biggest online retailer to we seem to sell a lot of pants. And we understand, because we've been watching people for 10 years buying pants, we understand what makes people buy pants. Now let's manufacture our own brand of pants. Now let's sell people not other people's diapers, but we will sell our own brand of diapers. So that's so when people say that Amazon hasn't made a profit yet, it's not like Tesla not making a profit. This is a company that says every time we make another billion dollars, they have so many different units, they will move money from one unit to the other, to not to shore up their books, but to say, okay, well, we need some more money to fund this idea. So and also you also tend to look at what shareholders are doing, and shares of Amazon keep going up. But the Amazon stock is doing extremely well, which means that whatever they're doing, shareholders are very, very happy with it. I think Warren Buffett said that he still wishes that he had bought Amazon early.
No. He said, I didn't buy Amazon because Amazon is a miracle and I don't invest in miracles.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
He said he wished he'd bought Microsoft. And he said, now I can't buy Microsoft because I'm friends with Bill. I've always made this point that looking at Amazon's profit is silly, because they totally can. They have it. Basically, Amazon's Jeff Bezos has a knob in his office that says profit, and he can turn it up and down depending on how much money he wants to take off the table this quarter. And most of the time, he wants to put it back in the company. But that does raise – it's relevant with Apple because, of course, of this $100 billion stock buyback. Apple's in a very good position cash-wise, and they're doing something that shareholders love, which is buying back a bunch of stock, which means the shareholders the outstanding stock is more valuable. Warren Buffett loves that.
And it's not just shareholders.
But should they – who else loves a $100 billion buyback? I know who doesn't.
Employees.
Ralph Nader.
I know, yeah. But employees,
They're shareholders. That's why. Their stock options more valuable.
But it's really important to understand the math. It's not just the people. It's not the Carl Icahn and
William Buffett. Carl Icahn.
But the thing is that if the stock goes down regularly in a highly competitive market for talent, they have a huge talent retention problem. So when you look at that buying that, it's not – employee retention is a huge deal in Silicon Valley, and people and a lot of their income is coming from stock, from shares. And so, they get a smaller salary and a huge set of shares. They'll all be millionaires when they leave, as long as it keeps going up. So these buybacks are not simply to handle outside people. It's also to handle inside people and make sure that they stay happy.
Ralph Nader, I'm not sure I'd – well, anyway – let's just say Ralph Nader published an open letter to Tim Cook saying there were so many better ways you could spend that $100 billion. He said if you took 2% of it, $2 billion, you could have wore a full year's pay bonus to the 350,000 Foxconn workers who sweat for your immense wealth in difficult workplace conditions, unable to afford the Apple phones they manufacture. Mm-hmm. You could, I'm not sure, this one's more interesting. You could also invest in research and development. And, of course, he's interested in the public benefit, so to diminish the effects of your company's toxic supply chain. Or, you know, make the next big thing. You could cut your prices.
These are all, I'd like to point out, these are all suggestions from someone who's never actually run a company.
No,
I mean, they are just the most boneheaded, you know, it's just like, this is the stupid stuff that, I mean, as someone who struggles through day to day making payroll and moving forward, these are the idiotic things that people say when they don't, when they've never run their own company, you know, like, you know, whether, you know, there are, because there are really, there are two sets of people, then people kind of fit between them. There are people who are on payroll and people trying to make payroll. Yeah. And the thing is, people who are on payroll shouldn't often talk about the people trying to make payroll, because it's a war, you know? And the thing is like the stuff that he's talking about, okay, we're going to pay people more. Well, changing people's salaries, you know, is an incredible, you know, endeavor, especially when you have hundreds of thousands of employees. You know, R&D to make things better, they're already spending that money on that. You know, they don't need $100 billion.
Well, we should point out that they're close to becoming the largest spender on R&D in the world. Neil Seibert says this about Avalon. And their ramp up is significant over the last few years.
And they're constantly spending money on finding ways to make things more, you know, where they're getting goods out of Africa, where they're doing all these other things. That is something that they're constantly running little drips of. They may already be doing
what Nader's talking about.
The thing is, they have
one thing
the
they're not doing is dropping the price of their products.
No, but those things like but dropping
people
price,
pay it.
But that's a permanent thing that you do, you know, in a company that doesn't affect, oh, we got money right now. It affects, you know, it makes way more sense to make capital investments, which they're doing constantly, because capital investments are a much better investment, because you have the money right now, you spend it on right now. What you don't do is start changing your payroll or your prices.
I also have been convinced by Tim saying, was it Tim or it was somebody at Apple saying, you really don't want to buy big companies. These historically, you know, Dell buying EMC or Compaq, HP buying Compaq, historically have not gone well because
culture.
Because culture.
Yeah.
It's hard to absorb these big companies. I actually kind of honor Apple's, you know, very careful, judicious purchase of companies.
Yeah.
I think there's something to comment on, though, is the sort of ideology behind what Ralf Nader was talking about. Yeah, when it comes to logistics, it's boneheaded. But the idea of it, that $100 billion, that's a lot of money, right? That's a lot of money, and 2% of $1 billion is still a lot of money. I think maybe what we can kind of take from what Nader had said in his open letter is maybe Apple could do a little bit more socially conscious activities with some of its money, instead of just helping the shareholders make more money. And I mean, if you're just talking, just take $2 billion away from the $100 billion, but the shareholders are still happy. They're still the largest buyback that any corporation has ever done, but just a little bit here and there isn't hurting Apple very much.
The assumption would be that they're not already doing some of those things. Now, I will say that all corporations would benefit from doing more outreach. So making a difference in the world is a cheap way for companies, in my opinion, to build up their brand, to get, you know, I remember watching, this is a decade ago, I watched somebody talk about if Chevrolet took its budget for advertising, you know, and took, you know, 10% of that budget and decided to push it towards you know, outreach. You know, they could literally have lunch with every person that bought a Chevrolet car, you know, a month later to find out how it goes. And they still have $100 million to do all these other things. And the thing is that the warm fuzzies that we would get about Chevrolet would be at a whole different level. And the same way with Apple or Google or Facebook or all these people that are, you know, when you're doing all those, and a lot of these companies are spending a lot of money on making a difference. I mean, you know, maybe not as loudly or as much money as they could, but most of them are engaged in those things. I think Apple is probably one of the ones that is probably the most quietly engaged. They oftentimes, when they're giving money away, they don't want their logo anywhere. They don't want, you know, they just want to help things happen.
You know, so when we think publicity point of view, it'd be great to make a big deal about it. But I've always kind of been of the, you know, you don't let the left hand know what the right hand's doing attitude.
I've worked on events that Apple has helped with,
and
no logos.
Yeah.
Not even Apple speakers. You know, Apple just
that means they're doing good for doing good as opposed to the corporate benefit.
So I think that we don't. But we're not conscious of it. So you get Ralf Nader's name. You do it. Yeah. But you know, there's. Go ahead.
I think that's I also think that's kind of a tone deaf comment for him to make. I think that Apple has demonstrated that they do better than almost every other company of its scale in terms of trying to treat its workers correctly. They don't just simply put buffers between themselves and their labor force so that they can say, oh, well, our contractor was supposed to. Ooh, that contractor. Oh, we're going to give that contractor a stern talking to. Yeah, let me tell you, even though, you know, the trick, of course, is that these other companies, they just simply say, we will pay you 28 cents for this panel.
Right.
And
you figure it out.
And we insist that we pay your workers at least $5 an hour. It's like, no, that doesn't work that way. Yeah. I think that, I mean, especially when you have such a huge glowing target in the form of Amazon, where I'm starting to get, I'm really concerned about what they're doing to the labor force. It's starting to almost feel like one of the worst things that can happen to a community is to have like an Amazon warehouse in it. It's great for the people who are ordering from Amazon because they get really quick shipping, but they just don't pay their workers well. They just don't treat their workers right. They just don't get retention. And so when they're getting all these tax breaks for saying, oh, we're going to bring 3,000 jobs into the community, yeah, but they're really terrible jobs. It's they're people that will take any job. So I'm not saying that the people are foolish for taking them, but I do think that Amazon should be held to a higher standard. That if maybe that's one of the reasons why they keep themselves. I'm joking, but if they had $200 billion worth of just cash on hand, I think there'd be a lot more pointed. Yeah, you really can afford to. You really can afford to give health care to like most of your workers. You really can afford to treat them right and not.
Well, look
them
at Walmart. Pressure. I mean, you really want
to. I try not to.
But I think that
about retailing that really begs people to do that kind of thing, I guess.
Well, the problem with the math over time is that, you know, the warehouses are being run by people because they haven't got the machines working yet, I one of the things that probably impacted me the most when I was my first job, I was in shipping and receiving for an electronics company. And so I just packed gear all day. And they moved our minimum wage. I was getting paid $3.55 a minimum wage at the time, and they moved it to $3.75, and 30 people were fired. So,
wow.
And the reason 30 people were fired was because there was this math of a surface mount machine that was going to, you know, build all the circuit boards instead of people. And the math was simply when it had to amortize over, I don't know how many years, 2 years or 5 years or whatever it was. And as soon as they went over that, they crested that number, you know, someone in the back office just said, oh, we hit it. And boom, they just bought the machine. And it was like within weeks after the raise, suddenly there were 30 people that lost their job. So I think because I saw it so early, I've always remembered that there's the other side of doing that is when you start ticking that number up. You also create the incentive. We'll probably not have a McDonald's 10 years from now that has more than 4 employees.
You sound like such a capitalist, Alex.
I'm not. You know what's funny is I'm
going to get you a monocle and a Monopoly, man.
I'm just a realist.
Penny bags.
I'm a realist. I think that we just have to be careful of that. There are.
It's easy from the outside to say, oh, you ought to do this, you ought to do that, and we do that. I do that all the time to Apple, but we have to remember that Apple's doing the, you know. Presumably, and I think Tim Cook has a good heart.
Yeah, and I think that we just have to be careful of thinking that it's just it's a simple equation.
It's not that simple.
You know, I think that, you know, we've spent most of our free time and capital working in Africa and all over the world, you know, because I think that it makes a difference, you know. But I think, you know, so I believe in trying to figure out ways to do that. But I think that we also have to realize that when we say we're going to, you know, those things seem like a simple solution, and then they never are, and then people end up losing their jobs because we go down that path.
Yeah. Well, I'm not suggesting it's simple. You're right. But I think that there is always a way to treat low-level employees with dignity, and I don't think that they consistently treat those employees with dignity. And that's one of the problems that I have with Walmart as well. When you have a consistent problem of someone being told to punch out but then come right back in, and if you don't, basically your review is coming up, that's criminal. Yeah. Then that's.
When somebody says that the best way to spend $130 billion is to do a space program, you know, I feel like there are a lot of other ways.
That's what Jeff Bezos said, isn't it? He said, "I'm going to take my lottery winnings from Amazon, at least he acknowledges that they're basically lottery winnings.
Right.
And there's nothing else I could do with this that would be of value.
To me, that speaks to a complete resignation in the value of the human race. Like, no, like I feel like it's a separation. It is a separation.
It's also kind of nutty.
Well, right? But I think it's a separation feeling like I can't help. I can't fix anything.
We need a new planet.
I want to go somewhere else. Planet. You know.
Okay. Can I have actually spoken to Jeff Bezos personally face to face about this, and he's a believer in space. He's not. This isn't a giving up. This is the next step for humanity is to be able to do work in space. And once we do work in space, that means we can live in space. So that's I do believe that he's a keeper of the faith when it comes to space travel.
I also should point out, sometimes we assume that these multi-billionaires and their vast fortunes, which are vast for an individual, could make a significant difference in charity. But, you know, governments put trillions of dollars. I mean, there's
badly.
They may do it badly. All right. I think that what a few billion dollars can do is nice, but it's not really as much as it might seem to be compared to, you know, the budgets of some of these big NGOs. And I mean, it's, although I have to say what Bill Gates has done with his fortune exactly. I don't know. We're not experts on this stuff.
But the only thing I'll say, because if I don't limit it to one sentence, it will be another half hour of rat holing. But I think that part of the central problem is when people try to put money into communities instead of putting wealth into communities, instead of finding a way so that a certain group of people, and define them however you want, are paid money for what they do, and they get to keep that money in the form of property, in the form of services, in the form of giving that money, buying products and services from other people within that community. It's difficult when you see that you have a company that will go into a community, essentially pay people as little as they can get away with, which is okay, commercialism. That's perfectly fine, but not build anything that adds wealth to this area, adds wealth to this group of people. I know it's a complicated problem. We're building a cathedral. Whoever comes up with the right plan to solve it will not live long enough to see his plan actually completed. But it's like space travel. It's worth crazy people trying to work on this.
Well, and I think that microfinance, I think, is a really interesting.
I agree.
You know, I love microfinance. I do a lot of Kiva is like one of my pastimes.
Yeah, I love
and,
that.
And it's just amazing that you have these, you know, these individuals who are trying to raise $750 to buy a cow.
Can make a huge
difference. You know, you're changing a whole, you know, like, you know, getting those stories, I think is, and I think that, you know, scaling that up is something that, I don't think you have to end malaria as the only thing that you're doing. I think that, and I think all of us, can be part of those kinds of things.
That's a good point. Let's take a break. Got to get to that, the big story, the keyboard story. In just a bit, but first a word from ZipRecruiter. Now, if you are like Alex Lindsay, if you have a business or me, you know that the employees are the most important part of your business. Every business needs great people and a better way to find them. Something better than just, you know, crossing your fingers and throwing the listing up on a couple of job sites. You know, and hoping somebody will see it, you know. If you've got an opening, there's got to be the right person. They're out there somewhere. How do I reach them? Well, ZipRecruiter. First of all, when you post on ZipRecruiter, you're posting 100-plus job sites with a single click. So that's going to reach a maximum number of people out there, give you a much better chance to get that right person. But ZipRecruiter goes a little bit farther. They learn about what you're looking for. They identify people in their database, which has millions of resumes, current resumes. They identify people with the right experience, and then they invite those people to apply for your job. It's almost like they're a headhunter helping you find the right person. This has changed the way people hire. 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality employee through the site in just one day. One day, 80% get a quality candidate. And ZipRecruiter doesn't just stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you receive in that great ZipRecruiter interface, so you'll never miss a great match. Look, the right person, the right candidate is out there. ZipRecruiter is the right way to find them. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. We've used them. You should, too. In fact, you can do it for free right now at ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak. ZipRecruiter.com
/MacBreak. ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak, the smartest way to hire. We thank them so much for making it easy to find the best people. Lori Gill, I have never asked you this question. Do you like the new Macintosh laptop keyboards? Are you a butterfly girl?
Yes, I am. This is such an uncomfortable situation for me to be in. I have the 2016 MacBook 13-inch MacBook Pro with the Touch Bar, and I have had zero complications with the keyboard. But I know beyond a shadow of doubt, there is something wrong with that keyboard when thousands of people have had issues with it. So here I am recommending to my friends the new MacBook Pro, and I'm watching person after person after person tell me that they've had some kind of breakdown with their keyboard, that they had to take it in, have something replaced, take it in a second time, had something else replaced. It's dangerous territory here, and I really think Apple needs to address this. I think the petition to recall the Apple keyboard, it's on the right path. I don't think the computer needs to be recalled, but I think that similar to the way Apple released repair program for the Series 1 Apple Watch for the battery overheating and breaking apart the battery, the watch case, it's something like this. It needs to be addressed. Apple needs to offer something to help people repair their keyboards. And it has to extend well beyond any existing warranty. So my MacBook Pro is fine right now in 2017, not even a year after I bought it. But what's going to happen in 4 years, 5 years? Is my Mac keyboard going to have the same kind of issues? And I'm out of warranty and I have to pay $700 to get it fixed.
That's part of the problem is how expensive, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have the Butterfly One, Lori, the first generation, which I tried and rejected and got rid of that exact laptop that you have. I also didn't like the Touch Bar, but that's another story for another day. Then I got the next MacBook, which was Butterfly Two. That was a little better. I acknowledge that, but still bugged me. Now, Apple Insider actually went out and did some deep data diving. They collected data from Genius Bars in the U.S., which is interesting, as well as Apple-authorized third-party repair shops, to collect the number of problems with number of keyboard incidents. So the MacBook Pro, which had the old-fashioned keyboard and the from 2014, and I'll put 2015 in there, we're talking 2,120 incidents in 2014. Of them, 118 were keyboard problems. That's pretty good. In 2015, there were 1,904 episodes and 114 keyboard incidents. But then a big jump when you get to 2016, you had fewer total incidents, 1,402, but a big jump in the number, almost a 50% jump in the number of keyboard incidents. That seems to have settled down in 2017, but then these are newer computers. Yeah, maybe the Butterfly 2 fixed it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but with the class action suit, I thought it was interesting that there are two plaintiffs named, one of which bought their MacBook, I think, in 2015, but the other plaintiff bought theirs like this year. They bought it in January and they had problems in April. Which seems like good tactics. I made a note yesterday when I was reading the complaint that now I need to learn how class action suits work, because one of the things that the suit is claiming is that not just that these are problematic keyboards, but they are fundamentally defective. Not only are they defective, but Apple knew that they were defective, and that's part of the reasons why the suit is going forward. And I'm not sure how they're going to prove that. Because this isn't Apple had a problem with
gun email to Tim Cook from 2016 saying these keyboards, we're having real problems with these. before release, something like that.
Yeah, it was
chances
it was like
of that are slim, I would guess.
If the old timers like me remember the Twiggy floppy drives, the original Lisa,
yeah, that was
where
a problem.
Apple they were so determined not to go with another. They were so determined to go with an in-house solution that, and they could not get the damn thing to work, and they had to ship on time, and so there are all kinds of legal issues afterwards because they could prove that they knew the thing just didn't work properly, right. But they had made the ship date. So I don't know. I agree with Laurie. I think that I don't think that we necessarily need a recall, because again, that assumes that the entire design is defective. I don't think that's the case at all. But a warranty extension, I think, is exactly what is called for here. Just they don't have to have a big mea culpa. They don't have to say anything. They don't have to advertise anything. But if you come in with a keyboard with a problem, yes, the first time you bring it in, they're going to spritz it with the compressed air, like the service note says. But if it's clear that if you come back again, they're just going to swap out a brand new keyboard and not charge you for it. This is why it's always worth it to bring a problematic Apple product back to the Apple store, even if it's out of warranty. I had my MacBook Pro 2015. Obviously, it's like out of warranty by 2 years, and I got after lots of use, I got what I thought was a normal, oh, replace your battery is finally bad, replace it. And I thought that, okay, old age, I've been using it over and over, and I'm just going to have to pay to replace the battery. It's not going to cost that much money. But they took it in the back, and they realized that like a couple of the cells were swollen, and they replaced the battery for free. So again, it's not something that was advertised, but it's always worth it just to see if they'll do something for you under their "we're awesome" policy. And this is, if there's ever a time for Apple to be awesome, it's to make people convince people that if they have a keyboard with a problem, it's not going to cost them $700 to fix it, because for $700 you can probably get a Windows laptop with a much better keyboard.
I should point out that Rene Ritchie was the guy who put these numbers together. I think Apple Insider published percentages mostly. And the total number of incidents is not the total number across the board, just the ones that Apple Insider counted. What's relevant is the percentage of the total incidents that were keyboard incidents. And that did go up a lot in 2016. But nevertheless, even if it's 12 or 13% of overall, that does not rise to the level of, oh, my God, this thing is broken. So yeah, it is really more of a goodwill. I think it's going to be more of a goodwill they have to convince Apple of than of any failing. I mean, that's a small number.
Well, goodwill doesn't pay for lawyers. So the lawyers are going to want the whole thing.
Well,
but you're right.
See, what I'd like to see is the outcome is Apple rethinking the butterfly switch making a better keyboard next time around.
I would like them to just get rid of the keyboard. Like, I love the iPad.
What the hell are you
like
talking
literally
about?
Get rid of a keyboard?
Just like everything to be iOS.
No, iOS. If you look at like a Surface, the Surface is great because you can choose what you want. You know, like that way Andy and I can have big keys, and then other people can have butterfly keys, and you just attach it to the thing and put it together. It could still be Mac OS. I'm realistic that I don't think Mac OS is going to last forever. I don't want to give it up because I still spend 90% of my time that I spend on a Mac or on an Apple device is in front of a Mac.
The petition at change.org hasn't quite raised 25,000 signatures. I don't know how many millions of these they've sold, but that's not a huge number.
Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, who care? people like signing electronically a petition that means
nothing.
That doesn't mean anything. Yeah. But I do think, we've heard too much about, we've heard from too many people who've had these problems to think that, okay, well, you know, there was a fly got into the transporter chamber. It was a one in a million problem. I think that there is a weakness. I think it's been demonstrated there's a weakness to this keyboard that makes them. Once they go bad, they're just bad, and you're just not going to. There's no way to really pop off that keycap, get in there with a Q-tip and an isopropyl, and get that key switch working properly.
I mean, I think the physics of it are obvious. When you have less travel, it's going to be much more sensitive to anything that goes wrong. You know, I think that the physics of it just makes sense that the thinner these keys get and the less travel they're going to have when you hit them, the less reliable they're going to be. You know, so I think that. And I think it's easier to have grit and all kinds of other stuff. I mean, I know some people that just go through keyboards because they use them outside, you know, like they use them in construction sites. And so they, you know, so it's, you know, they, and they go through certain ones faster because of that.
I don't know which device I can shake more crumbs out of, the tray at the bottom of my toaster oven or my laptop keyboard. So it's a tough problem to solve. I don't think that Apple engineers have been lazy. I just think it's a big problem.
I still really
miss. You have to get a keyboard that doesn't have any kind of holes in it at all.
Right.
that's like a membrane keyboard. Logitech,
yeah.
Yeah. For your
nothing. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. It feels super mushy, but I'm using it right now on purpose to kind of test out like how it feels to not have any kind of spring back. So.
I really like travel. I mean, I ended up buying a couple of Lenovo laptops, and I'm still my main Mac laptop is the 2015. And I think there are a lot of people, you know, that's the number Apple should really look at, is how many people are buying a superannuated computer from Apple. Mm-hmm. They still sell it. If that 2015 15 inch is selling well, that's a signal more than anything else to Apple that people want that keyboard, right?
Or that computer. There's a lot of reasons for it. It's not just the keyboard.
Well, it has connectors. You're using it.
I'm still using
connectors
it.
Connectors and better keyboard. Mm-hmm. That's good
I'm
enough
assuming
for
me. That's part of the reason the keyboard, the Butterfly keyboard on the 2016 and newer has to do with the thickness of the Mac, which I think is one of the biggest selling points for Apple, is that their MacBook Pro is actually thinner than their MacBook Air and lighter than their MacBook Air. And so then how do you fix that? How do you sort of champion the thinnest, lightest laptop and then put back a keyboard that adds weight and size to it?
Well, I think the question is, do pros care that it's thinner? And I don't think that they
do. Apple cares a little too much.
I think that.
And how many millimeters would they need to add to give it some decent travel? Not a lot. A couple, three millimeters.
A lot of us that are pros still miss our 17-inch. I mean, we would be happy with it being thicker.
Every time we talk about this, there are people in the chat room say, well, forget that. Let's have a 17.
I mean, having it a little thicker have more travel on the keys and more battery. Almost every pro that I know would happily do that. You know, I think that I think it's fine to have MacBooks that are super thin for business types that don't care and just want to be super thin and make it easy for them to throw in. But for people who are actually creative pros, having it to be a little thicker with more travel and more battery would be huge. And better yet, a battery that I could pull out. Not that I'm bitter.
I'm really, Apple's kept this 15 inch.
Because a lot of us are still buying them,
and I've got to wonder. I mean, it doesn't have the touch bar. It has connectors and it has a better keyboard. But it's a 4-year-old processor. It's a Haswell processor. I really wonder if this. I mean, it's $2,000. Does it sell well? If it sold well, that would be a strong signal.
I don't think they'd get rid of it if it wasn't still selling.
And it's still on the site.
Yeah.
It must sell well, right?
Isn't that typical? Whenever they do a major rev, like when they came up with the first MacBook that deleted the DVD, the optical drive, they kept the last model of MacBook that had the optical drive on the price list because it is a pro-level model. There are people who are still going to buy them. I don't know what the exact metrics are, but it's a big motivator. Once you've been selling and manufacturing something for a few years, you've got all the tooling, you've got parts inventory that you got to get rid of. You're not going to sell it to an outlet store for the dollar store. So you may as well keep them around and take whatever money you're going to get for them.
So, Marco Arment, John Gruber, Jason Snell, Casey Johnston, a lot of big names, have said, you know, this is a mistake. Gruber said this is one of the biggest design screw-ups in Apple history. I think that's a little strong. But Marco Arment, Butterfly key switches are a design failure. They're fatally unreliable.
You don't even have to look to the professionals and the analysts to see that. For the 15 or 20 MacBook Pro owners that I know, 6 or 7 of them have
had
keyboard issues.
Really?
It's clearly an issue. You don't have to believe the pros on this. You just ask your friends around town and see how many of them comment on having a keyboard issue where they actually had to take it into an Apple store and have something done to it.
I would love to be able to say your long nightmare is almost over. June 4th, Tim Cook will come on stage at WWDC and announce new laptops, a MacBook with a great keyboard. We'll see. It's 2 or 3 weeks, right?
They'll say, but if they ever do, they're gonna couch it in terms of, we've taken everything we've learned about the super flat flat keys that everybody loves, and we've used it to create the second generation that Taz. Okay, now 2 millimeters of travel, not 0.52. But the point is, we weren't wrong. We were never wrong.
Well, no, we're never wrong. Earlier today, we did the iOS Today, and Megan Maroney said she really wanted these new Spigen cases to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the iMac, a Bondi blue iPhone 10 case. How about that, huh? Or a case that makes your iPhone 10 look just like the iPhone 1.
A giant
iPhone 1.
That's kind of fun.
Isn't that pretty?
That is pretty.
Kind of pretty. I kind of like it.
Every time I see on eBay where somebody got a hold of like an old Mac that had like a clear plastic case on it, that's the one I want. If it were possible to, like, and I'm sure that if you go to certain markets in China, someone will sell you like a replacement back case for an iPhone that is just simply clear plastic. I would almost switch back to the iPhone if I could buy a clear back iPhone. That is hot.
Yeah.
With a W.
Yeah. So this has kind of the markings that, you know, kind of to simulate the inside of the iPhone, like the Bondi blue was kind of transparent. I think that's very clever. I like it.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. Let's see. We're coming down to the end of the line on some of these. Eddie Q put his Lake Tahoe vacation home on sale. Do you care? No.
It's really nice. No.
Is it?
Did you see the pictures?
Are there pictures? Now we have to go look. Okay. All right.
The only thing I noticed about the home, if you look at the interior image, it's a little difficult, but isn't that Rene Ricci's living room wall pattern right now?
Oh, it is. My God. It's the Riverstone look.
Yeah.
This is a little too modern for me.
That was one of his little day trips. He's like, nice. He saw the stuff like just stacked up on the driveway. He said, oh, those are the extras. Why? You want them?
Nice material use, though. Yeah. I like the materials in this. It's pretty wood floor, but yeah.
Isn't it $11 million?
Oh, that's all. Yeah. Come on, Lori. It's down the road from you.
That's Bay Area money. That could be a 2-bedroom with like half a bath, a shared bathroom with the next door.
Right? Yeah. Or you have to have 6 roommates.
It's on Martis Camp, a development where people can golf and ski all year. Has a private chairlift to North Star. How about that?
It's not bad.
Do you ski, Lori?
I don't. Oh. I don't. I tried a couple times and failed miserably.
Yeah, me neither.
The only time I've ever skied is like in downtown Albany while I was in school. While I was in college, there's a steep like street that goes to the Capitol building, and for some reason they shut the street down so there could be like free downhill skiing. It's the only time I've ever been on skis.
Say it's private ski lift.
I would do that.
Q bought the land for $1.2 million in 2010, and took 15 years to develop it fully. So this has been a long project.
But the connectivity in there is awesome.
Yeah.
If I lived in the Bay Area, one of my favorite weekend hobbies would be going to like open houses of people who work at Apple and Google just to see how their design aesthetic for devices translates to houses.
Oh, that's interesting. That would be a good article. Lori, get to work on it.
All right.
That'd be a good article. That would be a fun thing to do some research on. Tim Cook, a graduate commencement address at Duke, his alma mater. And he challenged students to think different rather than accept the status quo, leave the world a better place. Following in the footsteps of Steve Jobs, Robert F. Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. He also talked about Apple's commitment to environment, privacy, immigration, and gun control, supporting the Me Too movement against sexual harassment, and students involved in the Stoneman Douglas High School shooting. I don't always see life as clearly as I do today, says Cook, but I've learned that the greatest challenge of life is knowing when to break with conventional wisdom. Don't just accept the world you inherit today. Don't just accept the status quo. No big challenge has ever been solved. No lasting improvement has ever been achieved unless people dare to try something different. Dare to think different.
I have to say, as beautiful as this speech is, there's a lot of isn't Apple great for what it's done, being done in this speech? And if that were my graduation, I would have been rolling my eyes at this at this sort of advertisement for the company. So
use offer code TimDuke2018 to get 5% off of accessories and cables.
All right, time for a break. Then our picks of the week. Lori Gill is here. Lori, you can do anything. Remember, you could be like Jim Dalrymple and recommend rock and roll. What last time you were here, you recommended something like a movie, right? You did.
Yeah,
you recommended the
did.
Third in that series of which movies?
The Suspiria.
Yeah.
Actually, I think it was the Mother of Tears is the one
Mother of Tears, you did. Yeah. And that got me all excited about a whole new thing. So I can't wait to hear what you've got for us. Andy,
it may not be as exciting this time.
Oh, come on, Lori. And I got a box. I got two boxes from Amazon right before the show. I'll show off something new, too.
Ooh.
Ooh. But first, a word from FreshBooks. We're talking to small business again. Streamline your operations with FreshBooks. I did back in 2004. I started using FreshBooks because I love doing what I do. I hate sending invoices. At the end of the month, I just hated firing up Microsoft Word and Excel. And I was invoicing a Canadian company because I was going up there to do a TV show for Rogers. And I had to figure out the different price, Canadian dollars and get all my expenses together. Oh, it was just a pain. But then Amber MacArthur told me about FreshBooks and it just changed my life. It made it so much easier. I could make beautiful invoices, easy as pie. It handled the currency conversions no problem. Snap a picture with the FreshBooks app of my receipts, automatically put them right into the FreshBooks invoice. Now, I have to say, in the interviewing 15 years, FreshBooks, first of all, has gained millions of customers. I think there's 10 million people now who use FreshBooks every single month to send invoices. You can track time if you bill by hours. You can capture expenses. But because FreshBooks is an online app, it's getting better. Every week you go and something new is there. It really has become cloud accounting without having to do any accounting. You can quickly access reports like outstanding balances, total profit. That's something a lot of freelancers never know. Am I making money? Not till the end of the year anyway. Keep tabs on your business no matter where you are with the FreshBooks mobile app. They've got one for iOS and Android. They automatically will connect up to your bank account and update expenses daily. You can import expenses in bulk with the CSV file import option. Take a picture of a receipt. So there's lots of ways to get your data in there. If you've got a team, I was a lone freelancer. But if you've got a team, you'll appreciate the team features. There's a My Team page. You can add team members on various permissions levels. Now you can create proposals right within FreshBooks, rich text, images, request your client's e-signature as they accept proposals. And, of course, track all of your non-invoice income as well, like online sales and ads. So it's all in there. And by the way, when it comes to invoices, nobody does it better than FreshBooks. You don't have to chase your clients for payment. You can accept online payments directly in that invoice, which means your clients can pay you like with a credit card or online. That means you're going to get paid on average 2 times faster. Bill for time by client, specific projects, send invoices, estimates, and proposals in many languages. They just added Spanish, Dutch, German, and Portuguese. They have also announced, this is brand new, a collaboration with Microsoft, which rolls out this summer, which means FreshBooks will work in your Outlook. So you can view and pay FreshBooks invoices, view and pay FreshBooks invoices, regardless of what device you view it from with Microsoft Outlook payments. That's going to even make it easier. Outlook users will be able to view invoices in their in-mail, click a button that says Pay Now. Most of your clients use Outlook, I promise you. And if your credit card is registered with Outlook payments, you can pay in one click. FreshBooks. Try it free for 30 days. It just gets better all the time at FreshBooks.com/MacBreak and enter MacBreak Weekly in the How Did You Hear About Us section. FreshBooks.com/MacBreak. We thank them so much for changing my life 14 years ago and maybe changing yours too and supporting MacBreak Weekly. All right, Lori, I got to hear it. What do you got?
My pick this week is the Oculus Go.
I have something that goes with that for my pick. So this is great. The standalone Oculus. Now, have you tried the original Oculus Rift? Can you compare it?
I have only just tested it when I was at GDC. I haven't owned it, and I've not used it for more than a few minutes at a time. But that being said, what I need to say about Oculus Go, it's not that it's the best or greatest. It's actually not. It pales in comparison to the Rift, but it is the VR headset for people who are just getting into VR. It's the everyman's headset. I am loving this. It's only $200, $250 if you get the larger software. It's easy to navigate. It doesn't have a lot of extra bells and whistles that are confusing. You're not plugged into a computer. You don't need a special phone to be able to get it to work. You don't need to have a special setup. It's perfect for someone like me who has always wanted to get into VR but wasn't willing to spend $500 on a device and have to upgrade to a computer that could actually support it. So that's why this is my pick. Not because it's the best device, because it's not, but because it's the best device for people who are just starting out with VR.
So you don't have to put a phone in it. It's completely all in one.
That's correct. Yeah,
that's good for $200. That's impressive, actually.
You have to have a smartphone in order to. You have to have a companion app, so that helps you with the setup. So for anybody out there who only has a flip phone or a Sidekick, you do need a smartphone in order to get it set up. But once you've got it set up, you don't use a phone anymore after that. Nice. So,
what's your favorite app? What do you like to do?
I've been playing Land's End, which is the same game company that made Monument Valley. God, I'm glad I remembered that.
Oh, I love the Monument Valley. That's a great game.
It's another puzzle game, but you're actually in VR doing it, so it's much more immersive. I found myself getting just a tiny bit motion sick from that particular one. So I only do it about 10 or 15 minutes at a time. I've also messed around with the Plex app, which is fantastic in VR.
You lie on your back and watch TV?
Yeah, you can. You can lie on your back. You can sit on the couch. Nice. You can, you can be anywhere. Your significant other can be watching one movie on, Netflix on the big screen, and you can be watching another movie in Hulu on your tiny version of a big screen.
Does that happen a lot in the Lori Gill household?
No, usually I'm playing video games. What's cool about VR movie watching is you really do feel like you're watching the big screen, even when it's just this tiny little thing that's right in front of your eyes. You get a sense of scale that doesn't fit with the reality, but your brain is processing it as a very big screen TV that you're watching. So it's a really fun experience.
And the Go is a higher resolution than the Rift. So you should, that movie,
higher resolution.
It's got a lower frame rate, but a higher resolution. Oh. So you're, but, it's a much higher resolution. The Go is much higher resolution than Netflix or Plex. So
you're seeing.
You'll see it.
Screen
fine.
Door at all? Like, can you see the pixels, Lori?
There is a little bit of that. It's usually just around the peripheral.
Okay.
So for me, being new to VR, I'm still learning how to not look up like this, but to actually look up like this to get that better frame.
Don't move your eyes, move your whole face, your whole head.
Right, yeah. So I see it a little, but I think it's because I'm still learning how to properly navigate inside VR, which it's not bad.
How does, I wear glasses. I guess I could do it with contacts, but I would prefer to wear my glasses at night.
I don't wear glasses, so I don't know exactly how it works, but it comes with this little rubber thing that goes around the inside of the headset
offset.
That supposedly helps with the glasses wearing. Again, I don't wear glasses, so I don't know what that's like or whether it's comfortable or not.
It's such a bummer. That's the biggest. That's my, like, when I have contacts in, I love doing Oculus.
Yeah, but I don't want to wear contacts when I'm watching movies at night. I don't mind for at work, but I take them out at night. I want to wear my glasses.
You can get your glasses. I find that with the Rift, at least, there's like this wrestling thing that happens. Yeah. You get your glasses, and then you get them. Like, you get them on, and then you have to get your glasses kind of in the right place. Yeah. And I would just replace. You can get lenses for your, for your Rift.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, but the problem is my son and I and my daughter, we all use it, so it's a little more complicated.
Like lenses you put over the regular screen.
Yeah, you get.
Oh, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. So if they have that for Go, you could actually get one for each person in the family because they're only $200.
Yeah, and the glasses are only $400.
Right, exactly.
Cool. Oculus Go, $200. Thank you, Lori.
Andy Inako, what do you got for us? Oh, you're muted. Is that us or is that you? He's pointing at himself.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
I muted my microphone because we were talking about Apple's like Apple recalls, and realized that while unpacking boxes, I came across a part of Apple history. This is an actual Twiggy drive.
Oh my God!
Wow!
So this was because as part of the settlement. As part of the settlement, these worked so badly that Apple was forced to, like, if you had like an original Lisa with these two defective Twiggy drives, you could just take the machine in. They would swap you for like a Mac XL or the upgraded Lisa that uses the Mac style discs. And they wound up with like a whole bunch of these pulls, and ages and ages and ages ago, who was in a service bay asked if I wanted one, and I said, "Hell yeah, I want one." They're dated.
Look at that!
Oh, wow.
Now, did he give you one of the Twiggy floppies to go along with it?
No, but it's been sort of on my list. Unfortunately, I put it off for so long that now they're actually cost money.
Because their fatal flaw was the opening for the floppy was right where your thumb goes when you put the disc.
And there was no. That was a certain comedy of errors. That's why anytime someone says that the Apple keyboard is defective, let's have a sense of perspective. This was either rude words you would have to rhyme with in order to describe how bad the Twiggy drive was.
Yeah.
But yes, this is a static art display, which is the best way to use a Twiggy drive to just simply observe it academically. don't actually put any floppies or data on it. As a static object, it works really, really well. It displaces air and it responds to gravity. So,
and of course, the Twiggy disks looked exactly like standard floppy disks, but were completely incompatible because they had holes in both sides, which is weird.
Yeah, they're trying to get more data on there, and so they're doing a bunch of screwy ideas. And it's a classic case of the not invented here syndrome, which is that yes, we could look to companies that do nothing but build data storage systems to build something for us, or hell, we've got engineers.
Well, it did have its the WAS drive controller, I think, on it, right? That was pretty impressive.
I'm looking for something with a glow of elegance and glory about it. I'll have to look closer later on.
Is that your pick? Everybody should run out and get a Twiggy drive.
I don't even know how much. Actually, one of the reasons why it not only is it cool that it made the pick, but like, gee, I saw someone like sell a Twiggy like Lisa for like $40,000. This has got to be worth, I don't know, like a burrito with guacamole at least. But no, my actual pick is a new TV I got last week. It actually was in the background because it was in my office last week. This is the TCL Series 6 4K HDR TV.
Did you get the Best Buy deal of $500 for the 55-inch?
No, that was for last year's model. This is a model that I had been sort of like waiting patiently on. This is my demonstration to myself that I can. I am not 8 years old anymore. If you offer me two marshmallows, if I wait an hour or one marshmallow now, I am capable of waiting for the two marshmallows, because this is the 2017 model of this was one of the best reviewed TVs ever. As a matter of fact, I think the Wirecutter named it as its best pick for a budget TV, but also its best pick for a 4K HDR TV all told. And this new version is better. It has more contrast zones. It has better build quality. A bunch of other things that I'm still factoring on, but it's a perfect TV for someone like me, where it replaces a TV I bought 10 years ago. It's now at the old TV is to the point where like the fluorescent illuminator is starting to like make this halo sort of effect in the middle of the TV. Also, I've successfully waited out every single fad. So I didn't buy a new TV before you needed to get the new 4K HDMI for content control. I didn't buy a new TV with a curved screen or 3D. I didn't even buy a 4K TV when there was HDR, but they hadn't figured out that we're going to have two standards in order to be compatible with all the content. So I wound up for $650, which is damn cheap of what you're getting, what I think is a reference model TV. Not in the sense that if you spend thousands of dollars on a home theater, why don't throw your money away for anything more expensive than this? But I'm saying that this is a list of all the features that are going to be important for the next 10 years. If you're not the sort of person that goes into the showroom with a colorimeter to check for every single corner for illumination and color balance, you just simply want something that is really, really good, that has every feature you're going to want, that you can get 10 years worth of use out of, and there's just something about you that says, I can't spend more than $1,000 on a TV, or else the spirit of my father will just haunt me for a long, long time, and he will not be pleased with me. So I've had it in the office for about half a week. Then I put it in the living room a few days ago. I had that wonderful experience where I started looking for 4K HDR content on Netflix and wound up spending a day and a half just watching television because it's like for someone who's been using a standard HD TV for 10 years and have only had 4K temporarily and not really just as a test environment for a few days, it really is an amazing upgrade. You will feel every dollar that you spent on this upgrade, and I'm very, very happy with it so far. The only bad things I could say about it so far are that if you go looking for dark spots, you will certainly find them in the very, very corners of the screen, that the illumination is not 100% consistent, but it's the sort of thing where you have to have the brightness up and you have to really look for it in order to find it. I don't find it distracting at all. I'm sure that if there's anything bad that's going to happen, it's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 weeks. But the first week report is good enough that I can recommend it. Like I said, it's just such a terrific value. Again, it's not for people who wouldn't blink at spending $3,000 on the absolute greatest set that's out there. But I'm damned if I can think of any way that this TV has cut a corner or it feels cheap in any way. Again, all the multiple HDMI ports, it has a Roku built in that's compatible with 4K and HDR. So you don't even have to plug it into an Apple TV or anything else. Has Ethernet in. Again, everything I would want to plug into it, I can plug into it. And like I said, I'm just really, really happy with it.
Actually, you'll be happy to know that Scott Wilkinson, our home theater guy, highly recommends these TVs. He says they're second really only to the OLED TVs that cost, as you know, a lot more. It's got Roku built in, which is fantastic. And it's 4K UHD, supports Dolby Vision, HDR. It's a pretty nice TV.
Both kinds, both HDR 10 and Dolby Vision. So
oh, both. Oh, that's
you're
nice.
Covered, you're covered either way. It has the 55-inch version has like 96 contrast zones, which is an upgrade from last year.
Oh, yeah, it uses Fold.
I don't know how many of these were on Amazon, but I just want to let you know that when I logged in, when you started this, it was available for one day, you know, available to ship or whatever, to schedule or whatever, and it's now temporarily out of stock.
Yeah. Yeah, they're flying. $650 for the 55-inch.
Flying off the shelves.
They're flying off the shelves.
Yeah. And again, it's exactly the amount of
Fold
money.
Fold backlighting is a very good way to do it, the local array dimming. So this is
$1,000 for a 65-inch HDR 4K is
unbelievable.
Insane.
I did have one of those moments as I was like, first when I was unpacking it and setting it up in the office, and then like when I moved it from the office into the living room, it's like, I wonder what 10-year-old me would think. Say, oh, by the way, not only do you have a 55-inch TV that's as good as a movie screen, you just sort of like picked it up and carried it. And,
right.
And
when, it's like, pretty amazing, and when, isn't it?
And, yeah. And there was a point which you were shifting, so you're actually kind of supporting its entire weight with only one hand as you were shifting it around.
Pretty amazing.
I think you would require a lot of explanation about or wonder if I got exposed to gamma rays. But what a wonderful 2018 it is that I got. It would cost me more money to buy smaller than a 55-inch TV, almost. Wow. It would cost me more money to get a lesser TV. It's really cool.
Yeah. TCLUSA.com. It's a Chinese company that is, I think, aggressively pursuing the U.S. market, which might explain why the prices
Just be a little bit careful. Again, there's a 2017 model that's now being discounted. That's what I think, Leo, you were talking about earlier. Best Buy had them discounted for $500. That was the one where I've been saving, like, everyone knows that on Black Friday on Amazon, I do like spend a week essentially turning my Twitter feed almost into the home shopping network, but only for stuff that I actually own and actually can recommend. And the reason why is that if I know that next year this is the year that I want to replace a TV, it's like I'm using the Amazon credits I get to buy a new TV. And I've been, after seeing the CES report, I knew in 2018, I knew that this is the one I was going to get. And I could have gotten the 2017 model, like, and waiting month after month after month saying, no, there's back in stock. Oh, those are $50 off. Like, no, wait for your two marshmallows, Andy. I know the one marshmallow will be delicious now, but if you can wait until May, you will have two marshmallows. Yeah. And now I'm happy with my two marshmallows.
Very nice. Excellent recommendation. Alex Lindsay, what do you got?
I have a show that I'm recommending.
A show?
Some people have seen this show, but I want to make sure that everybody's seen the show because it is just so
I always need a new show.
Have you been watching Chef's Table?
Chef's Table, no.
Did you see Hero Dreams of Sushi?
Love
okay.
that.
Great movie.
And over and over about chefs that are like him in different parts of the world.
Okay, all right.
And it is so incredibly well shot. So like it just you know, it's like Netflix gave Gleb, I can't think of his first name right now, but gave the director from Hero Dreams of Sushi just like, okay, now we're gonna give you the budget you want.
Same guy.
So they just let him loose.
Find more heroes.
Like and give you more money than you had for the first one. And so he's got the budget he needs. He's got, you know, he goes and finds these chefs all over the world.
The problem is I watch these shows and I get very hungry.
Oh yeah, David Gelb. And so it's incredibly well shot. And it's about people who are just incredible. They're these artists with food. And the last episode, I don't eat a lot of desserts. So I wasn't as excited about it. But the first three seasons are all just about these cooks all over the world. And it's just incredible stories of how they were successful, how they failed and came back up, how they somehow found their way. There's one about a guy from New York who ended up in Japan, and now he's got this great ramen, you know, restaurant. Wow. And incredible one about a great chef. And most of these are Michelin, you know, three star and Michelin restaurants.
Half hour too, which is nice.
Are they longer? They're longer than that. Okay. Maybe the dessert ones are shorter, but the normally they're 45 minutes or 50 minutes
still
long.
Still not really lengthy. Kind of a perfect amuse-bouche before you dig right into Westworld or something like that.
Yeah. I love, you know, and you look at them going, oh, I don't know which one I should do next, and then you realize that they're all just amazing and really inspiring, not just on the level of food, but on a level of just incredible artists being artists, and food happens to be the thing that they do. And just these, you know, intense guys that are really, and women, men and women that are really into this art form called cooking, you know. And what I love about it also, though, is that it's a testament to what is great about the media market right now, that this is not something that you'd see in most cable or TV or whatever. This is a odd niche market that Netflix invested in wisely, I think, because it's these kinds of verticals that I think that are just amazing. And it's just one of the best shot documentary series I've ever seen.
I can't wait.
So anyway,
I had fantasies when I was in Tokyo.
It's 4K HDR too, isn't it?
Oh, of course.
I think almost
everything on Netflix now is.
I think it might be, yeah.
Yeah, all the new stuff is being shot in HDR.
Andy, you'll have to tell me what it's like on your new 4K.
You don't have a 4K HDR TV?
I have a couple 4K. HDR, but I don't have the HDR yet. I have it in the office because we were testing streaming to the TV, but I don't have it in at home.
That's so nice.
I'm definitely going to stream it after I've had dinner and when it's like 10 hours before breakfast, because if I watch this at 4 p.m., that's going to be a 10,000 calorie dinner for sure.
You should watch it while you're eating dinner. I watched the first episode and your food that you're eating is like, oh, I'm just having this boring, you know, salad or something. But you're watching the episode and you're going, oh, yeah, that's so yummy looking.
It's tricking you.
That's dangerous. I was just like, it was a busy work day. I was having my usual like busy work day dinner and hit the DVR and I'm watching an episode of Chop when it's one of the kids tournaments. And I'm seeing these kids put together these like 9, 10, 11 year olds amazing dishes and only like a half an hour. And really I'm looking at my microwave burrito and thinking that I'm not very impressed with myself at this moment.
Well, at least you sous-vided it.
I did sous vide.
I have to be very careful about shows like that. They make it very hard to fast. Let's put it that way.
I had fantasies of going to Hiro's restaurant when we were in Tokyo. And then somebody told me, well, Obama and Abe ate there about 2 years ago, and he is now booked through his retirement. you cannot get in there,
right?
And you never will, because he's going to retire in a few years, and they're booked for the next five.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, yeah. Well, so much for that. I got a box today, and I always love it when presents come. And Lori, you noted, and you said, what is it? But I said, I'm going to save it for the end of the show. We had on Saturday on the new screensavers, Dale Baskin of DP Review reviewing the new 360-degree cameras. He took a look at the Rylo and the Fusion. He liked the Rylo for its price, $400. Mm-hmm. But he pointed out that for $200 more, you could get the new GoPro Fusion. And I went back and forth, but I feel like the higher resolution of the Fusion, I'm looking for the best possible picture. After looking at reviews on the GoPro Fusion, I thought maybe I made a mistake because the software apparently is terrible. But I ended up getting the Fusion, and I am pleased to say Alex Lindsay tells me
I made
the right choice. This camera is a 360-degree camera. So it's a GoPro with lenses front and back, each of which get 180 degrees. In fact, in order to make that work, you have to put two SD cards in, one for each camera, which is cuckoo. And then it's a little bigger than a GoPro, although I'm glad to say it comes with a selfie stick so that you can hold it. Because with a 360,
it's actually really nice. It's a selfie stick that's a tripod.
Yeah, you want to kind of put it up in the air. I'm not really recommending it because I haven't reviewed it yet, but I'm. What do you think?
So I have most of the 360 cameras.
I figured you did.
The little ones that you put on your iPhone all the way up to an Ozo.
Yeah. It's the $60,000 Nokia.
Yeah, they don't make them anymore. But anyway, so too much. $60,000 was too much. Anyway, yeah.
Turned out nobody wanted it.
Well, it's everybody.
Alex. Everybody wanted it. Nobody could afford it. Maybe that's a better way.
I have six of them. They're all paid off.
Six of them?
Yeah. They're all paid off.
So this is why we like to go to Alex's garage sales kits. Holy cow.
I think for a non-stereo high quality, this is the best one that's out there right now.
What do you mean non-stereo?
Well, it doesn't shoot stereo. It doesn't shoot stereo 360.
What's
so
stereo?
Stereo 3. Oh,
3D.
3D 360.
No, I don't like 3D, so I don't mind that.
So if you don't like that, it doesn't matter. What I like about it is that the don't do that.
Oh, yeah. That's a lens.
Yeah, that's a lens.
You can't put it down. That's the only bad thing.
One thing we,
there is no side on which you can put it.
Just set it in the case.
It has a case.
So anyway, it's the one thing we have to train everybody with the theta is like, don't set the theta down. Don't set the theta down. So my runaround camera that I use all the time is my theta. I take pictures. I don't usually shoot video with the theta because it's bad. But I shoot lots and lots of stills, and I do all kinds of HDRs, and I do a lot of other things with the theta. And I think it's the best all-around camera. For the quality, though, I for a camera that's under $1,000, it's not going to be stereo.
700.
This is great because the resolution's higher on the video.
Yeah.
And its stabilization is really great, so you can be
that's
walking.
Kind of intriguing to me.
So you can take your the selfie stick out.
Yeah.
And you can be walking along a path, and when you stitch it, it will it's got an accelerometer inside, so the software is grabbing all that data. And it actually will straighten out that it's not just tracking the information, and it creates this nice smooth, it's very GoPro-y,
right?
In the sense that it can do that, it can kind of smooth that out.
So you don't
out.
Need a gimbal. In other words, this is a gimbal.
It's got a virtual gimbal. Yeah. It's not perfect, but it's great.
It's and, software stabilization.
Yeah, software stabilization, but it's got information coming from the camera as well. So it is a great little camera to
I like the tripod built into the selfie stick. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. And
we should do shows design. With this maybe, huh?
Sure.
How is the audio on it?
I almost never use audio from any of these cameras. Yeah. So I always record it separately. I use them as scratch. I need to just use it to sync, but if I'm going to do audio, I do it with real tools.
Well, I'm thinking maybe bring it to the Pink concert. Nobody get mad at me if I watch the concert with my hand in the air the whole time.
Jeez.
Right?
I like the idea of having this show just in VR. So, you
could
just
watch it
on YouTube. Say. Yeah. Yeah. So, and you could see all the people behind the scenes doing the camera work. And it's just there. All you have to do is just turn around and you see everything.
Well, that's one of the things I'm kind of thinking about. So much of content is done kind of like theater with a proscenium. Like right. there's a place you look. So really, when you're going to use stuff like this, I would think you would want to do it. The same thing with a concert. You'd want to do it somewhere where there's stuff going on all around you. Does that seem the case?
That's the way we design 360 is always like, I want to be able to tell three or four stories with whatever I'm
simultaneously capturing.
And even when we're casting things, we've had stuff where we have different, but we literally design three, four, five stories that are going on.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so that you have, and they're all interrelated to each other. They're all, you're in a space, but we've thought of, we don't want you, a lot of the old-fashioned LA folks, sorry, but old-fashioned Hollywood folks.
You old-fashioned people.
They're all talking about, well, we use sound to guide you to look to where we want you to look, and then we're going to have you look over here. And we're like, no, we're just going to make, you know, all of it interesting. And, and so maybe it's only 5 minutes long, but you might want to watch it for 2 hours
several times.
All these other things that you want to gather.
Yeah. So that said, one of the best VR experiences I've ever had was when the first times that when I broke out, when I got the first Gear VR from Samsung, and it was that lip sync challenge show that's on like high number cable, whatever. But all they did was they put a 360 degree camera like on a tripod in the audience, and because I was standing in my office and I'm just standing, and the VR point of view is of someone standing in an audience, it was like being at a live event because I could turn around, I could look at the back of the room if I wanted to. It really did feel like it was such an immersive experience just standing in a crowd and doing what I do in a crowd, that when the song was over, muscle memory just got me applauding, and so I realized that, no, you, God damn it, you're an idiot.
Wow, that's actually pretty high recommendation if it's that vivid. So, Lori, we're going to be making stuff for you and your Oculus Go.
Yes. I can't wait.
More content.
You've got to get ready for the render time.
Put Star Wars
in it. Somebody said it takes, like, all day. I have an iMac Pro. Will that help?
Oh, it'll help, but it's still going to take a long time. Finally, so, you know, you'll like, if you shoot, like, this show,
I would never do that.
Render it all weekend.
I remember when you did it at the Ozo. You shot it 15 minutes, and the Ozo took a week.
Well, we had some technical issues. I had done a couple things wrong.
Not going to make it in podcasting. So if you want something less expensive, the Rylo has some really nice features. Watch Dale Baskin's review and read his review on DP Review.
The Rylo's really cool.
Yeah, and it's tiny and stuff. Right. The Fusion's just a little bigger and about $200 more expensive. I didn't get a Rylo, though. You know, I got the Fusion because why not, right? Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this thrilling, gripping, three-dimensional edition of Mac Break Weekly. We're so glad you were here today. Please come back every Tuesday around about 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. If you want to watch the show, you can watch the live stream, twit.tv/live. Don't feel too rushed to get here because we often take our time getting the show underway as we talk about movies and comic books.
Or be rushed because we're chit-chatting.
And you may want to see that between the show's content. You can watch it at twit.tv/live. If you're doing that, you should probably be in our chat room at irc.twit.tv. But we also make a compact edition, a mere 90-minute to two-hour edition available for download on and viewing at your leisure, on demand, as they say, at twit.tv/MBW, or subscribe in your favorite podcatcher. That way you'll have it ready to go whenever you're in the mood to hear from Andy Inatko of Inatko.com. And, of course, he writes for Fast Company as well. Or Alex Lindsay of Pixel Core. You can find him at the Twitter at AlexLindsay. S-A-Y. And, it's so nice to have Lori Gill back. Come back more. Deputy Manager, Editor,
Buy
More at Apple.
More Lori.
We love Lori. And thank you all for being here. Anything anybody wants? Lori, you want to plug anything?
I just want to plug my Oculus Go back in so that I can charge it and play it.
Fair enough. How about you, Alex Lindsay? What's up with in the Pixel Core and your endeavors?
The best thing to do is just to follow me on Twitter. We're going to be announcing some stuff soon. I'm just trying to finish it up. So
very nice. And Andy, an announcement sometime shortly after WWDC.
Hopefully something really good for people that maybe some people will enjoy hearing. I am going to be on Boston Public Radio again on Wednesday. So not this week Wednesday, but next week as we record. So keep an eye on my Twitter feed. It'll probably be about noon or so, but you can stream it live at wgbh.org.
Nice.
Or hear my past.
Are you coming out for WWDC?
No. I'm like the boxer in Pulp Fiction. My San Francisco privileges have been suspended.
Thanks for being here. Get back to work, folks. Break time is over. Bye-bye.